As automakers in Europe, Japan, and North America struggle, China's leading car maker, SAIC, says its third-quarter profit jumped ninefold in the latest quarter. Tax breaks and subsidies in its domestic Chinese market prompted a surge in sales. SAIC has joint venture manufacturing operations with General Motors and Volkswagen. It says it earned $371 million during its most recent quarter. More union locals representing Ford Motor Company workers in the U.S. have voted down proposals to bring Ford's labor costs in line with those of Chrysler and General Motors. Employees at two Michigan facilities have overwhelmingly rejected the proposals, and now at least eight United Auto Workers locals representing more than 12,000 Ford workers have turned down the proposed deal. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now in their new location at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop offers private lessons on all instruments in their brand new studios. They also provide a complete band and orchestra instrument repair and service department.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, offering lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and an early afternoon after hour from 1 to 3 p.m. featuring soups, sandwiches, salads, pastries, and specialty coffees. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will be returning to a topic certainly we have talked about before on the program, and that is healthcare reform. And this will be the first in what we're planning on doing, a series of programs trying to look at this issue from various kinds of perspectives. And the programs, no doubt, will be scattered throughout the schedule over the days and weeks to come, given that we have to deal with the schedules of a lot of different individual guests. And we're starting out this morning with two guests to talk about the legislation that has now been unveiled by the House, by Democrats in the House. And this happened just yesterday. They have now presented their version of health care reform. It does include a government insurance option, although not everyone, I'm sure, will be happy with the form that that option takes. There is also a major expansion of Medicaid. The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, said it will make affordable, quality health care available to all Americans. And of course, there's a long way between what we have now and something that the president will sign. This has to be voted on by the House. There will be a Senate version. The two have to be reconciled. And then finally, there will be something, and the hope is, I'm sure, of the administration, there will be something that the president can sign by the end of the year. Well, we have two guests joining us this morning to talk about where we are now in the whole conversation about health care reform. We have a Dr. Javette Orgain. She is president of the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. She works at the Mile Square Health Center at South Shore, Chicago. She also is associate professor of clinical family medicine at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and she is affiliated with University of Illinois Hospital and Medical Center and also Mercy Hospital. Also joining us is Sarah Collins. She's the vice president for the Affordable Health Insurance Program at the Commonwealth Fund. She is an economist who is interested in a number of things, including healthcare coverage. Before joining the fund, she was associate director, senior research associate at the New York Academy of Medicine in their Division of Health and Science Policy. And then also she worked as a journalist. She was associate editor at U.S. News and World Report, where she wrote articles on economics and healthcare. Questions certainly are welcome, and we'd like to bring people in the conversation. So whatever questions that you have, they're welcome, and I'm sure the guests will do their best to give you an answer. We do ask callers to try to be brief, and we ask that so we can keep things moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, questions from listeners are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Dr. Orgain, hello.
Good morning.
And
thank you.
Well, thank you very much for giving us your time. We certainly appreciate it. And to you, Dr. Collins, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
I expect that if I asked each of you to talk about the things that you thought were problematic about healthcare in America and how they should be changed, that you would each have a list, probably a fairly long list. But if I said this, I said, well, pick the top two or three things, and that'll give us a way to start. And then we can talk about how the proposal here either does or doesn't address those things. Maybe we could do that. So I'd ask you, I'll start with Dr. Orgain. So tell me, what are your top two or three things that you think are the most wrong about healthcare in America?
Well, first I would have to start with indicating the lack of insurance of all American citizens. Second, I would say that once we ensure that all those citizens have some kind of insurance plan, we need to have a primary care workforce to serve those patients. And then lastly, I would say that in addition to that, as a primary care physician, as a family physician, we believe that the payment to family physicians and primary care physicians for that service and for that comprehensive coordinated care needs to be enhanced. So those would be my top three in regards to healthcare reform in the system.
And well, let me ask Dr. Collins the same sort of question. What would be your top three?
You know, obviously, I feel the same way about the rapid growth and the uninsured. So 46.3 million people were uninsured last year. This is an increase of 8 million over the last since 2000. Another major problem that we're seeing increase is the number of people who are underinsured. So about 25 million people we estimate have such high out-of-pocket costs relative to their income, even though they have insurance coverage, that they are effectively underinsured. Related to that is the very rapid growth in healthcare costs. So we're seeing that in the rates of both underinsured and also as a driving force in the rising number of uninsured people, and the highly variable quality and costs across the country, which really reflects how fragmented the system is.
Okay. Well, if then let me just pick one of those things that's obviously on both of your list and seems to be at the top or near the top, and that is the fact that now we know, and it's a statistic that's cited again and again, that we have tens of millions of Americans who don't have insurance. So if you look now at at least what we think is on the table, we have something in the House, and maybe you have an idea what's likely to come out of the Senate. How well does that, and here I better say, let's start with Sarah Collins, and then we'll go to Dr. Orgain. How well does what seems to be on the table respond to this problem of the uninsured?
Well, the Congressional Budget Office has released numbers on estimates on both the House bill and also the latest Senate Finance bill. So they're projecting about 54 million people uninsured under current law by 2019. Under the House bill, that would drop by 36 million to 18 million people left uninsured. In the Senate, slightly less people covered under the Senate Finance bill, dropping about 29 million people, but still leaving about 25 million people uninsured. And part of that is obviously because these exclude people who are not legal residents.
Mm-hmm. So is that the main – that certainly was one of my questions, because you have to be careful. People are making sort of sweeping statements about how this is going to provide health care for everyone, except that it doesn't. There are still some people who are not covered. And perhaps that, people who are undocumented, is a major source. But is that pretty much it, or are there some other people who, for one reason or another, still aren't covered? It sounds like Dr. Orgain, did you want to jump in there?
Yes, I would have to say that in the current system, approximately 14,000 Americans lose their health insurance daily. So that's persons who may have been in the workforce who lost their employment based on the economic downturn.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to those that Dr. Collins mentioned that are under or uninsured, that's an additional 14,000 American families daily that are continuing to lose their insurance. And so if you exclude those persons who are undocumented, then we still have a large problem.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the public option, or what's being called the public option. And it seems that this is, for a lot of people, this has been a real point of contention, with either members saying that if it's there, they're not going to vote for it, or saying that if it's not there, they're not going to support anything that doesn't have it. You know, one way or another, either are some people saying this is really important, I think it should be there, or not. So now there is something in this bill that's called a public option. And again, here, let me ask Dr. Orgain, what exactly does that mean, at least in terms of what we know is in this House bill? And does that do what you think it should do? Because I would imagine that you would be you would say one of the things that you think would be important would be for that to be there, public option to be there.
The language in the current bill, in addition to what we're speaking about, is what they're recommending is an insurance exchange where private companies can sell policies in competition with the government, and the government would also provide subsidies to lower-income families. And so in addition to that, there would be the possibility of negotiation of payment rates to providers. However, the problem with the negotiation of the payment rates means that it's similar to Medicare payment, and the representatives from the American Academy of Family Physicians, which is our parent body of the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians, our concern that has been expressed to the government is that payment rate is not sufficient for primary care providers at this time. So that would be one of the problems that we see. In addition, there would be equal treatment of certain employed individuals in a public option or a health insurance exchange. The concern for us is the possibility of states opting out of a program such as that, primarily across the nation, if you are trying to have a portable health insurance such that persons who might leave Illinois or go to Minnesota or go to Colorado would have the same kind of health benefits, would not be excluded based on pre-existing conditions. If you had an opt-out, which is currently being discussed, then that would vary across the state, and that is part of what we are trying not to do. We're trying to have a coordinated system that would eliminate some of those complexities. So that would be one of the problems and concerns.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, again, Dr. Collins, you can talk a little bit more about what's been proposed. I guess I find it a little bit confusing about what exactly what is referred to as the public option here would do, or is it that I'm confused because we're talking about sort of two things? We're talking about something that would be that would work through private insurers and also something alongside that would work through the government. I guess I'm still kind of confused about that.
You know, I think it's really important to take a bit of a step back and
look at
the full framework of what's being proposed. And so what these bills essentially do, and they're all, I mean, the House bills, House bill now, just one bill, and the Senate Finance and also the Senate Help Committee bill, they essentially build on the existing structure of the insurance system and building on the strongest parts in the system or expanding the strongest parts in the system, which are the employer-based health system where about 160 million people get their coverage, and the Medicaid and state children's health insurance program. Both of those portions of the system, very healthy risk pools, broad risk pooling. And they aim to repair what are the weakest parts of the system, the individual insurance market, where people are underwritten on the basis of their health status. People have a really difficult time affording premiums through that market. There's no premium subsidy like you get through your employer. And also the small group market, where so many small employers are also highly challenged to get coverage that's affordable for their employees. And the way in which this is accomplished is by creating a health insurance exchange, so replacing or at least improving upon the individual and small group markets with this exchange, and placing blanket market regulations. So in no state in the country would a insurance company be able to underwrite you on the basis of your health status. There'd be age bans, so you couldn't be charged more than a margin if you're older. There would be no plan would be able to limit what they pay over your lifetime and benefits. There'd be no annual limits on what they would pay. So, and then prohibitions against rescissions, which we've heard a lot of. So some major improvements in that in in the individual market right now through this regulated exchange. Now, within that exchange, you would be able to purchase, if you didn't have coverage through your employer, you'd be able to purchase a private plan or a public plan in the House bill. So that's where the public option comes in. It comes in through this exchange, I think that helps a little bit to place this public option in the context of the broader system reform. Mm-hmm.
It still seems to me that here, though, and maybe again, I'm sort of confused that aside from the fact that there are some people who can't get insurance because of pre-existing conditions, and what this is doing is essentially sweeping that aside. It's saying to the insurance companies, well, you can't deny insurance to somebody because they have that. That there still is this issue of how it is that individuals are going to deal with their out-of-pocket cost, and there's still going to be a lot of people who are going to say, well, that's great that there's this policy is available, but I don't have the money to – I can't afford it.
Well, each bill would provide premium subsidies. There's no premium subsidy right now in the individual insurance market, but each bill would provide subsidies, which would cap the premiums that you would pay at a share of your income. So in the House bill, ranging from 2% at 133% of poverty, up to 12% for people who are earning about $88,000 a year. In addition, the other important feature of the exchange is establishing a minimum benefit floor. So there's a minimum benefit package that insurance companies would be required to offer. The public plan would be required to offer, and those would be different depending on your out-of-pocket cost responsibilities. So what we think of as actuarial value, or how much of your cost would be covered by your plan, and that would really vary by deductibles and coinsurance and things of that sort. And there would also be cost sharing subsidies for people in lower income households to offset those costs and essentially bring up the value of the plans for lower income households. So both premium subsidies and also cost-sharing subsidies.
Okay, so I guess, and as I understand it, what this ends up being is a way to satisfy both those people who say we need to do something for individuals who can't afford health insurance. So what we're going to do is we're going to say to you, if you can't afford it, or if you can maybe make part of it, we, the government, will help you with the payment. A compromise between that and those people who were saying that they don't want the government in the business of providing health care, so they're still saying, well, we still have to stay with private insurance companies. So the private insurance companies are going to provide the product, and then the government will help people pay for it if they need it. And that seems to be the only way that you can get enough people to sign on so that you can get this to pass. Do I sort of have that right?
Right. And then the other major piece being a significant expansion in both the Senate Finance and the House bills in eligibility for
right.
Medicaid.
Okay.
So Medicaid goes up to 133% of poverty in the Senate Finance bill, and 150% of poverty in the House bill. So that's also a major change in the system.
And Dr. Orgain, so I guess that might not be the way that you would, if you got a chance to design it, that might be the way that you would, or maybe the way that you would. So do you think that, how well do you think that addresses the particular problem that we've talked about? There are a lot of individuals that simply can't, for a variety of reasons, can't afford insurance, or maybe even if they could, the insurance companies won't insure them.
Well, from the patient perspective, as a physician looking at the patients, if you, under government plans such as Medicare and Medicaid, if you expand eligibility, you have those two plans that are in effect currently, and if you also add the public option for persons who may not qualify for Medicare and Medicaid, then you increase the number of persons who are then therefore covered. You add to that the models that bring those patients into the system, such as the medical homes and pilot medical home projects, reaching high-need beneficiaries and targeted high-need beneficiaries, then you get to increase coverage.
There's just one other question, and then I have a caller here I want to get to. I guess I do want to come back to one of the things you said earlier about the problem of physicians getting, you know, whoever is paying the bill being paid what it costs to deliver the service. And, you know, we have also said one of the problems with healthcare in the United States is the ever-escalating total cost, the bill, and how it is that, you know, compared to a lot of countries, we're spending a lot more per capita, but we're not healthier. I guess I'm interested in your reflection on how we deal with that, with the issue of how what physicians are paid for their services, and particularly if we're going to have more people in Medicaid, then that seems to me that issue of reimbursement becomes even more critical.
What we are promoting are payment incentives for selected primary care services, a 5% bonus for primary care services. We agree with that. A 10% bonus if these services are provided in a primary care shortage area, a health professional shortage areas, of which even in the urban area we still have health professional shortage areas. A definition of a primary care provider for purposes of this bonus payment that is expanded to include physicians or nurse practitioners who specialize in obstetrics and gynecology is something that's being considered in the plan, and making sure that we define the medical home as a practice that's led by physicians. So an additional something that was also added by Nancy Pelosi is the sustainable growth rate and changes in that formulary for Medicare payment, which is what we're also promoting. We believe that the incentives for primary care have to be increased in order to increase our workforce and the number of medical students who are interested in going to primary care who have exceptional loans to pay and worry that they will not be able to meet their own personal needs in this environment.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Maybe I'll just very quickly introduce again our two guests. The last person you heard, that's Dr. Javette Orgain. She is a physician. She's president of the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. She works at the Miles Square Health Center at South Shore, Chicago. She's also associate professor of clinical family medicine at University of Illinois, Chicago. Our other guest, Dr. Sarah Collins, she is a PhD doctor. She's an economist. She is vice president for the Affordable Health Insurance Program at the Commonwealth Fund. There she's does a number of things, including managing the fund's healthcare coverage and access program. Before that, she worked as Associate Director, Senior Research Associate at the New York Academy of Medicine in their Division of Health and Science Policy. And before that, she worked as a journalist. She was Associate Editor at U.S. News and World Report, where she wrote articles on economics and healthcare. And then we're talking about healthcare reform, trying to talk a little bit about where things stand now in Washington and with this conversation. And questions from listeners are welcome. 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to start us out in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I wish I could formulate this in a question, but I can't. So I'll just give you 3 points and ask for a reaction. It seems to me that, you know, the U.S. health non-system is illustrated in this time of, you know, paranoia about flu, et cetera, in that 10,000 public health workers have been laid off in the last year at the state level. It's just amazing, and I'm surprised we don't hear more about it. This 6,000 pages does address some really atrocious things that I've heard about. I guess in some states, a woman who has been battered, is in a relationship of battering, can be regarded almost as a pre-existing condition, and they can jack her rates. And that's an astonishing thing. And there are a lot of other things like that. But I'm a single-payer advocate. I've been there for a long time. And it seems to me that if you just look at where these subsidies are going that were just talked about, I understand that over 10 years, either $1 trillion or $900 million, that more than half of that, something like 550 of that, it would be dedicated to subsidizing middle and low income people. So that would be a direct pass through to the health insurance industry, who might perhaps, with this, you remember, other provisions, raise their efficiency some. I doubt it. But you know, even granting that and saying that they raise their efficiency 5 or 10%, that's still that 20% of that would go into inefficiencies in the existing health insurance system, which means that something like $200 billion over 10 years would just be, I can't think of the right verb to use on the radio. So thank you.
All right. Well, I'll go first, Professor Collins. You can respond to any of that that you like. Particularly, I guess I'm interested in the sort of the wind-up point about what this means for the big insurance company, for the insurance industry. Let's put it like that.
Well, it is a tremendous revenue boost for insurance companies. There's no question about it. So these are 36 million new people under the House bill that would have insurance coverage, and a part of that would be federally subsidized. So I think that the caller is correct, and that we do need to focus on the cost part of this as well, and having conditions that insurers need to meet as a condition of participation through the exchange. Now, the House bill and the Senate Health Bill place a minimum medical loss ratio standards at 85%. So meaning that 85% of your costs have to go of insurers' costs have to be of your premium has to be for medical care. So I think there is a desire on the part of the drafters of the bill to make sure that a lot of this money doesn't go towards feeding higher administrative costs and higher profits. And one place that there will be efficiencies is simply eliminating underwriting. So right now, underwriting contributes to a large share of the premium for people who are buying in the individual market or small employers that are buying coverage in the small group market. Marketing costs, also a very significant part of the premium right now, particularly for small employers. That will also potentially be erased or reduced because of this regulated exchange. So I think that having the public plan in the exchange is an attempt to lower both provider rates. I think the Dr. Orgain's point about the primary care piece being very important and part of this, and I think the bills do address primary care payment, the importance of primary care payments being increased relative to specialty care. But I think there is a strong case to be made for including the public plan option to put some downward pressure on premiums, and that you might not have that unless you had very significant controls if it were all private plans selling through the exchange.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Organa, you can, react to any part of that, any and all of that that you'd
like? Certainly. What I'd like to do is bring us home to Illinois in regards to what you might call a public option here in Illinois that's called Illinois Health Connect that increased the efficiencies, enrolled more of the under and uninsured into a program with primary care case management and with a medical home, and saved the state in its first year of operation approximately $1.2 million. And so that's a similar, if one wants to extrapolate that into a national system and compare it to a public option, that would be one that I would consider. It is a government-run system. It enhances our Medicaid and Medicare programs. There are certain qualifications for entry into the system, but it brought in to Illinois those persons who were under and underinsured with a medical home, with primary care case management, with chronic case management, and saved the state money. So as the caller indicated, the cost projection for the federal health reform is $900 billion over 10 years. If we can adopt some of these programs, expand Medicaid, bring those patients into the system, into a primary care, a patient-centered medical home, I believe that similarly at the federal level we can reduce those costs.
But again, I guess I come back real quick, and I have a caller here. I promise we'll get to them. It seems from what you've been saying, though, that we have to make sure that the personnel are there to be able to deliver the service at, of that level. That is, we need to have family practice doctors, and I'm sure that we need to have more nurses and support people and so forth, nurse practitioners, so that we can deliver that, that front, so that that sort of frontline service, the first person you see when you walk in the door, is there.
Absolutely. And so as part of healthcare reform, we have to talk about adequate funding of graduate medical education and for physicians, as well as education for other healthcare providers. And, loan repayment for those persons to go into health professional shortage areas, mm-hmm. and into those communities where there's a significant need.
All right. Let's talk with someone here on a cell phone. This is on our line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was interested in one of the reasons I called was about this cost shifting, and also that we passed legislation in Illinois not too long ago to cap lawsuits that were supposed to have controlled costs and reduced costs, but I haven't seen that happen yet at all. And I think that hearing about the government talking about reducing Medicare payments only exacerbates the problem. I think that is the problem, is that the more they reduce payments to doctors and hospitals and suppliers, the more they try to make it up by increasing costs, and that just hurts. I think that's why we have the problem in the first place. I just was interested in your comments, and I'll listen off air. Thank you.
All right. Well, Dr. Orgain, what might you say?
Unfortunately, the president, and I'll do both the federal and Illinois, the president has not come out in favor of tort reform at the level that we would like. And so at this point, from a federal perspective, it does not have enough teeth in it, and it is not quite represented. At the Illinois level, as she indicated, there had been legislation, but it has not been implemented, and it has been contested. And so we are not yet a state that has passed tort or has implemented tort reform. And so from a medical liability perspective, that is something that we ask our patients and our providers to continue to advocate for tort reform at both the state and the federal level. And that's one. And in regards to what the caller said, for providers passing on the cost to the consumer and to patients, well, one of the things that has occurred in regards to what's being proposed is the removal of the exemption from antitrust laws for the healthcare industry, which covers market allocation and price fixing and bid rigging. So that is one of the things that Nancy Pelosi introduced, and that's currently in the House bill. And the possibility of the Federal Trade Commission having authority to look into the healthcare industry in regards to fair trade practices. So those are some of the kinds of things that are being considered at this point.
Let me turn to Dr. Collins, and I'm particularly interested in your responding to this issue of tort reform and to what extent the problem with malpractice lawsuits, the cost that doctors have to bear to have insurance, all of that, to what extent that contributes to the overall cost of health care, and whether you think that that's something that we still have not yet addressed.
This is certainly an important issue for physicians. It's something that the House bill, they have a new provision that would establish voluntary state incentives grant program to pursue this issue. It is important in the overall rate of growth in healthcare costs, so our national health expenditures. It's a very tiny, if relatively small factor in the overall rate of growth in healthcare costs. The biggest drivers in healthcare costs and the bills do attempt to address those are this wide variation and inconsistency in costs and quality across the country. So technological change in healthcare, but also the inappropriate application of technology. And so the bills really try to address this through establishing comparative effectiveness centers, for example, changing the way in which providers are paid to incentivize the development of medical homes, as Dr. Orgain mentioned, accountable, what are known as accountable care organizations. So trying to bring some order and systemness to a system that isn't really a system, as one of the earlier callers mentioned. So I think that the issue is of cost is huge for the country. I think it's not driven by malpractice. The malpractice issue, that's an important issue, but it's not the main driver in healthcare costs.
Okay, and let's talk with another caller. This is someone who is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. It seems that the right wing is always talking about malpractice reform. But if we do get tort reform, if it's a reform, how are doctors going to discipline themselves? They've already shown that they are incapable of doing this. There are practically never doctors disciplined by the board. And when things get egregious enough, the doctor just moves on to a different state.
Well, Dr. Orgain, can you respond to that?
Well, I understand the caller's sentiments, and I'd like to take up from where Dr. Collins indicated in terms of the cost of healthcare reform or the cost to the medical industry or the healthcare industry in regards to consumers. The cost that we're speaking about in regards to tort reform goes to the providers, and the providers, the impression is that the providers then pass that on to the patients in regards to their malpractice liability insurance. Essentially, what we have in Illinois are a lack of physician services in parts of the state because of the medical liability. Neurosurgery in downstate Illinois is practically now trauma services and those kinds of services based on the cost of medical liability insurance to those specialists and therefore the lack of services. For he is right that some physicians do leave different states based on the level of malpractice insurance, but not necessarily because of the lack of policing of the industry. Certainly we recognize that medical errors are a big part of the cost to the healthcare industry. And we are working diligently to provide patient safety measures, beginning to increase our approach to patient safety and acknowledging medical errors. But there's a balance to that, and we have not yet, and I have to
actually, may I
approach that?
Yeah, go ahead. You, caller, you'd want to follow up? Go ahead.
Yes, I definitely do. She's ignoring the question. It seems to me that with the system we have today, the only control on malpractice is the legal reform of suing the doctor. If you remove that control, there seems to be no discipline at all. And she's ignoring that.
Well, Dr. Orgain?
Well, I just need to say that one is that from a perspective of quality management, That is standard in the medical and hospital practice and in the healthcare industry where we do quality management. And I'm hoping that somewhat answers the question where we review charts, we review cases, we provide continuing medical education for physicians in order to improve quality and coordination. And that's why I brought in the concern about medical errors. We are developing or beginning to develop more patient safety models. We have not gotten to the point where we, on a broad perspective, discuss the issue of physicians admitting their errors to families and what the consequences of that will be and what the programs for that will be. Mm. And so is there anything on a broad spectrum for admitting errors and dealing with those medical errors, that is in progress at this time. And well, I hope that sort of answers the question a little bit more.
I expect the caller probably won't find that very satisfying, but I'm going to have to jump in here because we just have about 10 minutes left and I have some other callers. We'll see if we can get back to this particular issue on some future programs. I do just very quickly want to introduce again our guests, Dr. Javette Orgain. She's president of the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. She works at the Mile Square Health Center at South Shore in Chicago. She's also associate professor of clinical family medicine at University of Illinois at Chicago. Also joining us is Dr. Sarah Collins. She's an economist. She's vice president for the Affordable Health Insurance Program at the Commonwealth Fund. And her responsibilities there, among other things, include the fund's health care coverage and access program. And this is the first in what we expect to be a number of programs that we'll be doing over the next weeks, probably, to try to talk about the legislation that's been proposed in Congress. We now have a House bill that is expected, I think, to go for a vote next week. And then there'll be one in the Senate, and then the two will have to be reconciled. And sometime, I think the administration's hope is that there will be a bill to sign before the end of the year. Questions are welcome. We'll try to get in as many as we can. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. A caller raised the question about who gets the benefits of the subsidies. And I'm wondering why there is no attempt to eliminate the 7.5% deductibility threshold for medical expenses. A family of four with $50,000 of income would have to rack up $3,750 in medical bills to even begin to take deductions. If the consumer is to directly benefit from any of these, why not go and eliminate that restriction and allow people to either directly take a credit for dollar for dollar for medical expenses they have, or at the least allow them to have a deductibility being brought down to basically all the costs. I'm wondering whether that is something that is even considered, and if not, why not?
All right. Well, it sounds like a question for our economist. Dr. Collins?
Well, a couple thoughts on that. Just to be clear, the premium subsidies, while they do go to insurance companies, they reduce the amount of premium that people pay. So the subsidy, I mean, just the transaction part of this, it if you are eligible on the basis of your income for a premium subsidy and you're purchasing through the health insurance exchange, that's the way it's done. The subsidy would go directly to the insurance company under the bills, but you benefit by having a lower premium than you otherwise would, and the same on the cost sharing side. So both of these bills, or all three of them, including when you include the Senate help bill, all three of them have reductions in cost sharing that also vary by income. If your income is over $88,000 and you're buying on the insurance exchange, then you are facing the full cost of the premium. Now the difference between now and in 2013, if that's when these do go into effect, is that you're facing lower premiums than you likely would have had you purchased on the individual market today versus buying through an exchange in 2013, primarily because of these new regulated benefits, lack of the restrictions on underwriting, and also the fact that you've got the minimum benefit standards are tiered, so you would have a sense of what your out-of-pocket costs would be. But that is an interesting point. I'm not sure that the bills address them. I haven't seen that point, but it's an interesting one.
I think my question was not about premium. My question was about costs that are incurred beyond paying premium because of out-of-pocket expenses that keep increasing. And there could be no better way to help the consumer than to allow deductibility of those expenses. I think that question wasn't answered. I'll hang up and listen. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I don't know. You want to, if there's anything that you can add to what you already said.
Well, the only thing is I think that the bills do address the out-of-pocket cost issue through the cost-sharing subsidies for people earning less than $88,000. And they address the out-of-pocket issue just by virtue of the fact that they're placing limits on what your out-of-pocket costs would be through the standard tiering. But I think the caller has an important point on the deductibility issue for costs that are end up being excessive, even with the reforms that we're talking about.
One of the things that I know a lot of people would argue adds significantly to the cost of health care is the cost of prescription medication. Does the legislation that's been proposed in the House or what seems to be there in the Senate, does that address the cost of prescription drugs at all?
You know, the one new provision in the House bill yesterday is that it proposes to phase out the donut hole in the Medicare prescription Part D program by 2019, and the other proposal is finally allowing the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate drug prices on behalf of Medicare beneficiaries. So those are particularly the latter is an effort to reduce the cost of prescription drugs.
I think that what Dr. Collins mentioned previously in regards to comparative effectiveness research also addresses the concern about medications effectiveness and being able to have a drug formulary that's based on actual effectiveness across the spectrum such that those prescription drug benefits are important and drug formularies would be important in all of the options.
So that I guess that would suggest to me that for physicians, do you think that there is some kind of issue here with I'm sure in their prescribing, physicians are trying to give their patients the medicine they think that is going to work best, but that doctors don't always have the best information to draw on to make that decision?
In addition to not necessarily having the best information, the question becomes across the plans, each plan has a specific formulary.
Uh-huh.
And drug costs vary based on pricing and what we were saying in terms of cost fixing. If one of the major insurance companies negotiates a price for a particular medication, then that is the cost of the drug. And if we can do some comparative effectiveness research and talk about the fact that one is that this class of drugs, this particular drug, has the same benefits, then we can try to deal with prescribing in a way that is cost-effective to our patients with the same effectiveness across the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. I think that it is true that so far the major medical organization, the American Medical Association, has not endorsed any particular plan or any particular piece of legislation. I'm sure that they are like the Academy of Family Physicians. You know, there are things that they think are important and issues that they think need to be addressed. Do you think the major physicians groups actually at some point be endorsing particular pieces of legislation?
In particular, the American Academy of Family Physicians is partnered with the Herndon Alliance, which is more than 200. The Herndon Alliance includes more than 200 faith-based labor, AARP, American College of Physicians, American Academy of Pediatrics. And that alliance and our partnership means that they, as we watch healthcare reform and continue with the debate, we will be providing input, those specific pieces in the legislation and how we can enhance the language of the legislation towards a final bill. And so we continue to monitor the progress out of each committee, and regularly, our leadership regularly provides input in regards to specific language.
Mm.
So at the point in which we've come to that out of conference, we may not be satisfied with the entire bill, but recognizing that it's a step forward towards healthcare reform and get something passed while we continue to work on true system change.
That I want to turn to Dr. Collins, and I think that that's a point that that people have debated. That is the point being whether you what you really want to do is to have the most change that you possibly can, or do you change what you can and then say that's what we've done today, and that in the future we'll continue on this. And so that seems to be always that there having been this argument between wholesale change and incremental change. And I think that a lot of people, as Dr. Orgain had said, are looking at what's going on now and are saying, well, maybe this is not everything that we would like, but that we've achieved, if we can do this, that's a good first step, and that we go on from there. And so I guess my question is, do you think that something's going to get passed? Was that in a sense like the opening shot of what is going to be a long, you know, many years long process of changing healthcare in the United States?
I absolutely think so. And I do think these are more than incremental changes. I think these are the bills really are proposing a substantial change from where we are right now in terms of covering, you know, providing access to universal coverage, providing and dealing with the underinsurance issue, and then putting us on a path to achieve greater systemness and savings throughout the system. I think it's very true that this is not going to end this year. That this is not static. That health you see this in Europe. They have changed and modified their health systems over the years. So it's a continual process of tweaking and changing and improving. Another example is Massachusetts. So Massachusetts passed what is very similar to what's being proposed in these bills, a universal coverage law, mixed public-private type approach. And now they're dealing with the cost issue because they didn't include that in their legislation, and so they're very aggressively moving towards addressing the cost issue. So this is an evolving process, and it's very important to sort of get to this first stage where we sort of break through and make this major change in our insurance system and our health system in general, and then improve it over time.
Well, we're at the point here where we're going to have to stop. I have one last caller here. I really must apologize. We don't have time to take the call. However, I will say that we're planning on trying to do more shows with different sorts of guests to talk about this whole big business of healthcare reform and how things go along here in the weeks to come. So please do hang with us. Let me just give Dr. Orgain particularly one last opportunity. Any sort of closing comments you'd like to make and leave with folks?
Well, I'd like to, the caller who was not necessarily satisfied in regards to the medical liability, we need to continue to have the discussion. And I must admit that those of us who are in the physician community in regards to medical errors, I would like to say that one is we need to certainly move towards more healthy exchange in regards to our medical errors and what that would mean for the patient, and begin to dialogue with patients when we're in those kind of situations, and if our answers were not necessarily satisfactory, we're trying to work towards some change in regards to those medical errors. But I would also like to encourage our patients and the physician community to continue to advocate for healthcare reform. We believe that it must be changed. We believe that these are absolutely times in which your voice needs to be heard. We have the American Academy of Family Physicians website where you can go and get some information in regards to healthcare legislation and talking points to your legislators, and I would encourage you to do that.
All right. There, we must thank our guests, Dr. Javette Orgain. She's president of the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. And Dr. Orgain, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Sarah Collins, she's the vice president for Affordable Health Insurance, the Affordable Health Insurance Program of the Commonwealth Fund. They also have a website if you want to find out what they're all about. And to you, Dr. Collins, thank you very much.
Thank you.
WILL programs are made possible by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information available at 359-7377. We will take a break at this point, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the commodity markets and some news from National Public Radio. We'll be back. Please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where prices in corn and soybeans are down, giving back part of the previous session's gains, as we're seeing a rebound in the dollar today. And the weekend also having some people willing to take profits ahead of next week and what that might bring. Key markets such as oil and copper were down about 2% each, while the some of the other markets are also seeing profit taking as well. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat 503.5 is down 4.5. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 494 is down 9.75. December corn 368.25, down 11.25. March 381, down 11.5. July 401, down 8.5. November soybeans 974, down 11.5.